Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And this week with us, we have Father Charles Connor. He's a professor of systemic theology and church history at Mount St. Mary Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland. He has co-produced dozens of series for EWTN and is actively engaged in preaching retreats for priests and laity throughout the United States. A priest of the Diocese of Scranton, Pennsylvania, he served in diocesan parishes for 18 years, including as rector of St. Peter's Cathedral in Scranton. Father Connor holds a number of degrees from the likes of the University of Scranton, Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium, Fordham University in New York City, the Gregorian University in Rome, the Angelicum University in Rome, the Pontifical John Paul II Institute for Studies on Marriage and Family in Washington, D.C. He's authored numerous books, and today we're going to take a look at his latest from Sophia Institute Press, entitled Pioneer Priests and Makeshift Altars, A History of Catholicism in the 13 Colonies. Welcome to the show, Father Charles.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you.
So let's get started here. And before we get too deep into it, Father, I have to say this is a fascinating read, partly because I'm here in the area where it's written about. Maryland's right down the road from me. I've attended...
Oh, yes.
I've attended Mass at the Sacred Heart Basilica, Conewaga Chapel, multiple times, and we'll get into that, how it weaves into your book as well. So I have to ask, what prompted you to write this particular book?
The publisher, they wanted something done in this area and thought that it was quite necessary because our Catholic people really did not have a real grasp on our origins here in the British colony. So I was asked to develop this theme and write on it.
Okay, well, that...
but it was also something of great interest to me, so it was kind of it worked well on both ends, so to speak.
Yeah, great. So you talk in the book about the on again off again relationship, so to speak, with Catholics and the monarchy in England in the 1500s and 1600s. Can you tell us a bit about what Catholics were facing during those years in Europe as a whole?
Oh, sure. Well, it was, for our purposes here, rather than talking about Europe as a whole, I mean, England is, England would be as important as any other country in Western Europe that was hit by the devastations of the Protestant Revolt.
Okay.
But we are particularly concerned with England because it was, of course, from England the colonists came to the eastern seaboard of the United States. And so any time after the ascendancy of Henry VIII, I mean, you had a brief period of time where Mary Tudor, his daughter, was affectionately referred to by Protestants as Bloody Mary, but she was queen for some time. She died rather young. She was succeeded by her half-sister Elizabeth, who was the daughter of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, who ruled for decades and was militantly anti-Catholic. So you have a period of several decades where Catholics had to really go into hiding, so to speak, in England. Even the wealthier, more affluent ones, who generally, because of their social prestige, would not have been nearly as bothered, I would say, by the monarchy. But nonetheless, they had to keep very, very quiet. And so many of them lived in manor houses far distant from London, and they maintained private chapels and chaplains and all this kind of thing. So the faith was able to endure in England in many ways. But yet, as I say, many, many had to go into hiding. I suppose one of the more splendid examples would be the story in the city of York of St. Margaret of Clitheroe, who ultimately was murdered for the faith when one little Protestant kid got into her house. She was a schoolmaster in a place called the Shambles, which was anything but a shambles. It was a very, very exclusive part of the city of York, and she was well known for opening her home for Catholic masses and hiding priests and all this. And this little Protestant kid from Holland, his family had moved from York, and he was sent there to be instructed by her as a schoolmistress, and somehow he found out, and he went and told his parents and so forth, and that was ultimately the end of St. Margaret Clitheroe, who was martyred for the faith. She would be one example of many. I mean, you can find many priests hiding holes to this day all over England, and hear the stories of so much heroism. Now, there was an ebb and flow, of course, in British history. I mean, some periods were a little bit easier on Catholics than others, but most particularly during Elizabeth's reign, it would seem that things were very, very fierce. Not so much by her personally, but because I think she always lived with certain regrets that she may have had, but certainly those who were within her cabinet ranks and ministries and so forth were blatantly anti-Catholic and made no secret about it at all, and strongly, strongly persecuted Catholics, murdered so many. There were so many who died in the Tower of London, for example. There were many who died at the Hill of Tyburn, which you can still visit in London. And there's a very wonderful convent there of cloistered Benedictine nuns, the Benedictines of Montmartre in Paris, who ultimately opened a foundation at Tyburn Hill. And in the basement chapel of their convent, there are dozens upon dozens upon dozens of relics of martyrs who died for the faith in England. So it was an extremely difficult time for us, obviously, and certainly something that should not under any condition be forgotten. You know, it's we hear so many people, and very, very rightly so, talking about their own nationalities and more particularly even about their own religious backgrounds and how they were persecuted and how they were discriminated against. Not nearly enough has been said about how much Catholics were persecuted and discriminated against.
Right.
And I think more has to be said about it.
Right. And that's an interesting point. You know, when you talk about Catholicism and Christianity in general, you automatically go back to the persecutions that the early Christians faced in Rome. But, you know, you mentioned it a couple of times there in a dialogue. Catholics in England had a rough time. They did face death under certain rulers.
Mm-hmm. So. Oh, indeed, they did. Absolutely, no question about that. Yes, and many, many martyrs. You know, you can talk about people like St. Edmund Campion, who is particularly well known. You can talk about the 40 martyrs of England and Wales, who were canonized much in our own time by blessed, please God, soon to be Saint Pope Paul VI, and it was about 1970, as I recall, they were canonized, and many, many others who lost their lives in so many different places of incarceration in England, particularly in the 16th century, but also into the 17th.
Mm. So, as we go along through your book, we come to a period of time where Lord Baltimore comes along, establishes a colony in what we now know as Maryland, but they had a hard time getting people to come. So if Catholics were having such these difficulties in England, why didn't they flock to the New World immediately?
Well, there were a few reasons for that. First of all, Maryland was the Chesapeake was not his first venture. His first venture was up in Newfoundland in Canada, and he did attract a rather large number. But they found the weather, the winters there so intense that they just pleaded with him to return to England because they said this colonial experience is just not going to last. That would be one thing. On his second try. On his second try, he did manage to fill both the Ark and the Dove. Now, remember that no matter how you looked at this thing, it was an expensive proposition. That was one thing. And there's a natural fear in the part of many people, no matter how bad they may have it in the homeland, there's a natural fear of moving across the sea so far away and so far distant from family and kin and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And also the very, very real actuality of having to start a new kind of life and begin a new kind of work and establish a colony. And well, what kind of work do you do when you get there? And this sort of thing, you know. So it was certainly a fear of the unknown that also kept many, many people from going. But at the same time, he did, as I say, succeed in attracting a large number on the initial voyage, and then many, many more as the early decades of the 17th century went on. The initial voyage arrived in St. Clement's Island, mm-hmm. on the Feast of Our Lady's Annunciation, March 25th, 1634. But, I mean, the shiploads of both lay people and Jesuits kept coming to southern Maryland in larger and larger numbers, and they would increase the original population that were there and help them to establish the colony, which they did ultimately in in St. Mary's City. But so they would be some of the reasons why many did not come. But as I said, many did. And those who did, it's interesting, were of a social class in England that the voyage for them was not necessarily any financial hardship. They didn't have to come up with loads of money to make the voyage, as so many people would. And that's why they were the ones who were initially attracted to come. And they expected to establish in the colony of Maryland, the Palatinate of Maryland, as the land grant officially was given to Lord Baltimore, they expected to establish a very, very fine life socially, politically, and all this kind of thing that they had enjoyed in England, and many of them did because they were wealthy gentry people. So you had these wealthy Catholics. You did have members of the C of E, the Church of England, who were also rather well-to-do people and settled in an adventurous spirit with the Calverts. And you also had indentured servants who came. They were affectionately referred to as His Majesty's 7-year passengers, because what would happen is they would indenture themselves to these very rich families. They would work for them for a period of 7 years, and then they would be granted their freedom and allowed to either return to England if they saw fit or establish a life for themselves in colonial Maryland, which the overwhelming majority of them did. And on that initial voyage, there were two Jesuit priests and one Jesuit brother. And then, of course, the numbers of English Jesuits who came were fairly decent, actually, as the 17th century continued until the suppression of the Society of Jesus. But in any event, of that original crew that arrived in 1634, we would have to make particular mention, I think, of Father Andrew White, who was a real, real hero. He wrote an extraordinarily interesting narrative of the journey to Maryland, describing all of the hardships that they had from the time they left the port of Grosvenor in England until they arrived in the Chesapeake in March. And his story, as I say, was a very, very unique one. And it was Father White, who had been a very well-educated man in England, who was a professor of theology and the like on the continent in Europe. And he gave it all up to become a missionary to the New World. He became very, very close with the Piscataway Indian tribe, and he ultimately received into the faith the chief of the tribe, and his wife and his family became Catholics. Father White wrote a catechism in the Piscataway dialect and was able to converse with the native Indians, the American Indians, in their native tongue. So he was an extraordinary man. He later returned to England when conditions started to become very adverse for Catholics here in the colonies, and he had been at one time chaplain to the Arundels of Water before he came to the United States, and he, I think, returned and was either with them or with some other substantially wealthy Catholic family outside of London at the time of his death. But Father White was an extraordinary man and well remembered, certainly in the annals of Southern Maryland history. And it was these Jesuits, not only the original three, but those who followed in subsequent expeditions to the New World, who would establish manor homes. And in so many of these manor homes, you had the development of the earliest parish churches and cemeteries, right, and parochial life that dotted the landscape of Southern Maryland.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media. The Catholic solution to the healthcare problem is here. Paying too much for your healthcare costs? Solidarity HealthShare is a healthcare sharing ministry which provides an ethical way to fund healthcare costs while protecting and practicing our Catholic beliefs. Best yet, Solidarity HealthShare's members are exempt from the fines and penalties in the Affordable Care Act. For more info, call 844-313-4999. Again, that's 844-313-4999, or visit SolidarityHealthShare.org. That's SolidarityHealthShare.org. Media. I'm Pete Sox, Catholic book blogger. Today with us, we have Father Charles Connor. We're discussing his book, Pioneer Priests and Makeshift Altars, A History of Catholicism in the 13 Colonies. We're just getting started the last segment. And Father, one thing you pointed out in the book, and we just had a little conversation about it here prior to that, is Southern Maryland and this entire area that we're talking about, South Central Pennsylvania, is really steeped in Catholic history, and I think one of the reasons you alluded to that the publisher wanted this book written is that not many people really understand how much history is here.
That's true, and you know, Peter, one of the interesting things is when you read the American history textbooks, everybody, it seems, is familiar with things like we usually call them the Pilgrims. They're more properly the Separatists who began Plymouth Plantation in Massachusetts, you know, and had the first Thanksgiving and all this stuff, and the Puritans who settled the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and the early English settlers who came to Jamestown, Virginia, and all the rest. These are the things that are stressed. At least I hope they're still being stressed to children in both public and, I suppose, parochial schools as well. The history of the United States, and very, very rightly so. What is not stressed is the fact that just a few very brief years after these Protestant groups arrived, as early as 1634, Catholics were here in Southern Maryland. And I really think that, you know, our own Catholic people do not necessarily have an appreciation, not that it's not their fault that they don't. I mean, it's just something that was never emphasized.
Right.
And as a result, we do not have a sufficient appreciation for, number one, how early we were here, and number two, how much hardship we had to endure, and number three, and this is a vitally, vitally, vitally important point that has to be made. When the colonists came to Maryland, to Southern Maryland, the Catholics were in the ascendancy all for the first decade or 15 years or so of the colonial establishment. And what must be underscored is the fact that absolute religious toleration was extended to everyone who came to the Maryland colony, no matter who he or she was or what religious creed they professed. With the subsequent events that took place in England, I'm thinking now about the events of 1650, for example, you had that decade of what we usually refer to as the period of the Protectorate and Commonwealth under Oliver Cromwell and his rump parliament. You had savage brutality, I would call it, against Catholics both in England and in America. All liberties were, and freedoms obviously were denied. In other words, those who had extended religious toleration were the ones who were deprived of religious toleration by this horrendous, horrendous Protestant bigotry that took place under Cromwell, and then again that took place under after the fall of the Stuarts and the glorious revolution of William and Mary coming to the throne in England about 1690. And that's why I say it's a complicated colonial picture. I mean, you have to look at each one of these decades to see how many freedoms and privileges and liberties were enjoyed at one time and how many they were deprived of at another time. But the fact of the matter is, when the Catholics were in ascendancy, and the period was so brief in colonial Maryland, and also when they were in the ascendancy in the 1680s in New York under the royal governor Thomas Dongan, who was himself a very, very staunch Roman Catholic, complete religious toleration was extended in New York. When Catholics fell from power, this religious toleration was denied. And there, you know, one of the most poignant quotes I think I've ever heard from an American historian is a man who lived decades, oh, he's been dead for decades and decades. His name was Arthur Schlesinger Sr. And he and his son, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., were both United States historians. Schlesinger Jr. Served in some capacity in Kennedy's administration in the 1960s. But he was a historian by profession, as was his father before him. Now, the father made an interesting statement many, 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 many decades ago. He said, anti-Catholicism is the most deeply seated bias in the American people. And I find no reason to contradict the man's statement all these many years later, really.
Yeah, that's a very good point. One of the things that you brought up numerous times, I think we need to touch upon, is what exactly was the role of the Jesuits in the spread of Catholicism in the United States?
Well, it was tremendous because the Jesuits were members of the English society, of course, and they came here, and as I say, they were the ones who went into Southern Maryland and did phenomenal work establishing through their manor houses, the original parishes, and very, very rudimentary kind of schools. You couldn't get any kind of higher education at all, as we'll talk about hopefully later. But they did that, and also we would have to speak very much of the Jesuit missionaries who went into Pennsylvania, those who began Catholicism within the very cosmopolitan atmosphere of the city of Philadelphia, but also those missionaries who extended themselves way beyond Philadelphia, which is a story I try to speak of as well. And you were mentioning to me the Conowago Chapel, which yes, you and I know very, very well, the affectionately called the Basilica. It's a minor basilica of the Sacred Heart, the oldest church in the Western Hemisphere dedicated to the Sacred Heart, very close to McSherrystown, Pennsylvania. Yes. And it is a phenomenal monument to colonial Catholicism and to the particularly the German Catholics who settled both in, well, certainly in the city of Philadelphia, but also who settled in the areas of south central and southeastern Pennsylvania, and the tremendous work done by German Jesuits for these people who were primarily, not exclusively from the Rhineland, but primarily from there. William Penn did a wonderful job of publishing promotional tracts throughout Germany, and really attracting many, many German people of all kinds of Protestant denominations as well into his colony of Pennsylvania, where he extended a very significant religious toleration, though I would say in general Penn had a rather low opinion of Catholicism itself. But he at least was willing to allow Catholics to worship and give them freedoms and so on and so forth.
Well, since you brought the Conowago Chapel up, let's talk a little bit about that, because you do mention it in your book, and it was sometime around the 1730s when the Catholics in Maryland decided to leave some religious suppression behind and travel north, and they settled along Conowago Creek and started a Catholic community.
Indeed they did, yes.
And it's interesting that at the time they were still, they just didn't come up here and just build a chapel, because even here in Pennsylvania when they settled, they were still meeting in mass houses. So at what point did it come along that they received the freedom to be able to safely say, we're building a church and we're establishing a Catholic community here?
Well, much of that freedom had traditionally been present under William Penn, and of course they were far removed, obviously, from any the major site of colonial government. So I don't know of any instance to speak of that they were interfered with in the building of that church, or also in the construction of the cemetery, which goes back long before the American Revolution. It's interesting too that the Jesuits owned all of that land surrounding the Conowago Chapel, and it's less than a decade. Maybe 8 or 9 years, or 7 or 8 years, since the Maryland Society of Jesus sold off the last parcels of land to private individuals. They actually held it from colonial times right down to our own time. But no, I'm not aware of anything legally prohibitive against the building of churches, at that later date in Pennsylvania. And as I said, Penn is much, much to be credited for the freedom that was granted throughout his colony.
One of the things I found really interesting in your book, and you know that's why I tend to read books, is to learn, is that the founding fathers actually had sort of an anti-Catholic mindset, didn't they?
Oh, they most certainly did. Every one of them. One of the classic examples of that, in fact, I do cite it in the book, is John Adams' impression of a Catholic Mass. He was, of course, a delegate to the Second Continental Congress from Massachusetts, and he was strolling one afternoon, and he came and sat in the back of Old St. Mary's in Philadelphia while Mass was going on, and he wrote a description of it to his wife Abigail. And in one sense, you could be mowed over laughing with it. It's so ridiculous, you know. At the same time, you see that poor Adams was so befuddled, had not the remotest scintilla of a clue what was going on in the Catholic Church. I mean, it just had him completely befuddled. And he expressed this befuddlement to Abigail in a language that is very, very, very amusing, to say the least. But yes, all of them. I mean, Hamilton was anti-Catholic, as was Jefferson, as was Patrick Henry. They all, any one of them you could point to. To a lesser degree, I would say James Madison, because when the Sulpicians came to Baltimore to establish St. Mary Seminary, they had briefly there a day school for boys, and Madison was open-minded enough, shall we say, to send a couple of his sons to the day school of St. Mary's in Baltimore, and they were taught by Sulpician priests. The people like the Carrolls, of course, who were so socially prestigious in Maryland, were very much respected by the founding fathers, despite the fact that of their Catholicism. But in so many, many instances, just in the public pronouncements, even the Second Continental Congress itself, who really tried to initiate Canadian help during the Revolutionary War. They sent, in fact, Samuel Chase and Charles Carroll, and Charles asked his cousin Archbishop John Carroll to go on this mission to Canada. The mission was largely unsuccessful, but they were extending the olive branch to Canada, and the Continental Congress said, well, we cannot believe that you would possibly allow religious differences to interfere with the magnanimous help that we know you probably would like to give in the cause of liberty and all this other stuff. Less than a year before that, however, when the British government passed the Quebec Act, extending the French rule into the Mississippi Valley and the legitimacy of that French rule, and therefore helped Catholicism within the Mississippi Valley, the Continental Congress was irate, because it was it was nothing more than, as far as they were concerned, than the spread of Catholicism. So I mean, it was one thing when they needed Canadian help. It was quite another, of course, when England seemed to be acting against their interests, their religious interests anyway, and halting the growth of Protestantism. And of course, the same thing would hold true in 1778 with the famous Treaty of Amity and Commerce, when we enlisted the help of the French, and the French gave us both military and help and manpower, and tremendously aided the success of the victory during the Revolutionary War. And that was something that Washington himself referred back to when the representatives of the Catholic Church in the United States wrote to congratulate him on his election to the highest post in the country. He said, I presume you will not forget the tremendous part played in the winning of our national independence by a nation in which the Roman Catholic faith is professed. He was obviously talking about France at that point. Washington himself seems to have been above the fray as far as religious bigotry is concerned, but the rest of them were the absolute descendants of the Protestant Reformation as well as the secular Enlightenment, and that came out so very, very much in their writings and in their thinking, naturally.
Okay. Well, with that, we're going to take another quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media, and we'll be right back. Cleanliness is next to godliness. Do our closets have anything to say about the state of our souls? Popular Catholic speaker and Bible expert Mary Elizabeth Sperry explores the relationship between our stuff and Catholic beliefs in her new book on decluttering in the spiritual life, Making Room for God. She boldly affirms the goodness of our stuff and of God's abiding presence in the worldly goods all around us. She also reminds us of how sin can distort our relationships, including the ones we have with our possessions. Check out Making Room for God at AveMariaPress.com or look for it wherever books and ebooks are sold. Back to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, Catholic book blogger. We're here today with Father Charles Connor discussing his book, Pioneer Priests and Makeshift Altars, from Sophia Institute Press. And Father Charles, again, fascinating topic. Glad you wrote the book. And another thing that jumped out at me that I was truly not aware of, and that was the sort of mutual respect and relationship that the Quakers and Catholics had for each other. And can you explain to us a little bit how they were able to work together?
Yes, yes. Well, the Quakers, of course, were begun in England by George Fox, and they have been known. They have been known certainly for their pacifism, you know, and so many wars of our national past. They were always very often conscientious objectors and this kind of thing, would set up all kinds of agencies of assistance during war years. And they had a very, very broad-minded view of life and of individuals. And they operated from a position of what they referred to as peace from the center. And, of course, that peace was to be extended to all men. So it was in many ways a nondescript religious creed, in the sense that it was not doctrinaire in any way, shape, or form, but it was a religious sect that seemed to be open to all people, all Christians, Jews, anyone and everyone, you know, to extend to, if we would say, the olive branch of peace and tranquility and all the rest. So, you know, with that kind of a background, they found it rather easy to accept the concept of religious toleration, and also to work amicably with anybody who ever, you know, who might be within their general proximity, let's say. And so there were, as you say, very good relations between both the early Catholic settlers and Penn's Quakers.
And we briefly touched upon this last segment, but I'd like to get into it a little bit further. With the, at that time period, somewhat, well, I'll call it a suppression, it's not really the right word, but of Catholicism within the colonies, what were Catholics' role in the Revolutionary War?
Well, it's interesting. It's a kind of a fascinating topic to look at, because by the time we got to the Revolutionary War in the 1770s, we had been here for 140-some years, I guess, and there had been a Catholic presence here. And throughout that period of time, you had, as I mentioned earlier, this series of ongoing pieces of anti-Catholic legislation from one colony to another colony to another. And some places were so bitter that, I mean, Catholics were simply not, some colonies, I should say, were so bitter that Catholics were not even allowed to settle to maintain a residence within the colony. Now, that in itself was prescribed in certain colonial laws, and certainly there'd be no such thing as voting or owning property or running for political office. And, you know, they were just not even recognized as human beings, so to speak. So you had all this kind of thing in the background, and yet we would have to say that the majority of Catholics did indeed support the Patriot cause. And the only reason that historians have traditionally given is they saw in that Patriot cause, they saw in the breaking away from the mother country, not necessarily a breaking away from religious bigotry, but I think a greater opportunity based upon what was conceived in the initial notions and well circulated in the initial notions about liberty and what was going to be envisioned in a new nation, that they thought that their lot would be a better one. And because of that, they threw themselves with great enthusiasm, for the most part, into the American Revolutionary cause, and they distinguished themselves militarily in the Revolutionary War, no question about that, and came out of that war. It was one of a series of many, many passages, let us say, of assimilation into American life, and this is certainly one of the earliest and most significant opportunities that the colonial Catholic population that became the revolutionary Catholic population had to prove their ability to be as patriotic and as loyal to the new nation as all of their fellow compatriots. Now, at the same time, it also should be noted that there were Catholics, particularly in the city of Philadelphia, who were, I guess you could best describe them as somewhat fearsome of any kind of liberty to be gained or any kind of breakaway from an established order. And so, therefore, there were rather significant numbers of Catholics in Philadelphia who were loyalists. They were primarily to be found at Old St. Mary's Parish in Philadelphia, and some of them were some of the Scotch Highland Catholics in the Allegheny Mountains of Pennsylvania were also much attracted to loyalism. I don't know of any significant numbers of them in Maryland who were, but in Pennsylvania, the numbers were rather significant, surprisingly significant, loyalist brigades, that remained loyal to England and very much opposed to the revolutionary cause. But they would be, again, a minority. First of all, we're speaking of a Catholic population of about 25,000. Now, naturally, we're using round numbers here, but it would be about 25,000 at the time of the Revolutionary War. And of that 25,000, you had maybe a few thousand who were loyalists. But the overwhelming number, as I say, did indeed support the patriot cause.
So it's interesting. Post-Revolutionary War, the Catholics stepped up, helped the cause, and then we have this mass move again where they spread out to Kentucky.
Oh, yes, that was after the Revolution in 1780s and so forth. It was that spirit of democracy, the spirit of manifest destiny, that became even stronger in the 19th century. But they saw the possibilities of a better life in the farmlands of certain counties of Kentucky and so forth. Hardin County would be one. And they went there in very significant numbers from southern Maryland. And, you know, even to this day, there is a significant organization of individuals. I once in a while even receive some literature from them. They are the descendants of those who left southern Maryland and who whose forebears came and settled in the frontier of Kentucky, especially around the area of Bardstown. And, in 1808, there were four suffragan sees that were established from the Archdiocese of Baltimore. And they were New York, Philadelphia, Boston, the major metropolitan centers, but also the somewhat unlikely locale of Bardstown, Kentucky. And it was thought that that was going to be such a flourishing Catholic area, and indeed it was, but not to the point that it developed like the major eastern cities did. And so ultimately the Diocese of Bardstown was assimilated into the Archdiocese of Louisville, Kentucky. But in any event, yes, there was a very significant hundreds of families from southern Maryland, and we do treat that in the book and the various counties in which they settled and the various families that settled there and so forth. It's quite a significant story of Catholic migration in itself to Maryland. But this organization I began to tell you about have annual, or even semi-annual meetings where the descendants all get together and they listen to papers and accounts and so forth that became part and parcel of family folklore telling the story of this Catholic migration from southern Maryland.
Fascinating stuff. One other area that we haven't talked about yet, and I want to come back to the chapel in the last segment, but we haven't touched upon in detail New York. Obviously, the Catholics did go up there and migrated to there as well. Can you tell us a little bit about when that happened and how that all came to be?
Sure. Well, most people studying the colonial history of New York know about the original Dutch settlements. And there were, one or two instances anyway of Catholics settling there under the Dutch, but really having no access at all, except maybe once a year or something to some traveling Catholic priest who would go through. In 1664, in a very, very peaceful kind of a way, because the Dutch were so weak in New York at that time, Peter Stuyvesant was the last Dutch governor, and of course he ultimately relinquished control of the colony to the British, who came in and, as I say, in a very, very peaceful way, just simply transferred power, if you will, to themselves, and they began the system of government, which ultimately led to the formation of the royal colony of New York. And of course, what was significant, as I mentioned earlier, for the royal colony was when James Stuart, who became James II, was the last Catholic monarch of England. He was the brother of Charles II, and when he was the Duke of York, his brother had made him the royal governor of New York, and then ultimately he succeeded to the throne himself as James II. He and his brother, by the way, are both buried in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. But anyway, it was he who appointed Governor Thomas Dongan, who was a native Irishman and who was in power for only 3 or 4 years as the governor of the Royal Colony of New York, right on the eve of the Glorious Revolution, 1688, 1689, when he fell from power, obviously, and the Protestants gained an ascendancy once again in colonial New York. But in those 3 years or so, you have the Charter of Rights and Privileges that were passed under Governor Dongan. You had all of the New York Jews, for example, being made freedmen of the city of New York, which was a phenomenal kind of a thing at such an early time in history. And it's unfortunate in many ways that Dongan's period was so limited as royal governor, considering the good he could have done had he remained in office. He was exiled, and he lived over on a farm on Staten Island for some years. And as conditions worsened in the 1690s against Catholics, he was able to be smuggled out on a ship, and he made it to England, and he lived very, very quietly in the city of London for the rest of his life. But he contributed significantly, as had his co-religionists so many decades earlier in Southern Maryland. And it's quite an interesting story that, again, I keep repeating this, that under these brief periods of Catholic rule, you find no exception to the concept of religious toleration. In the opposite periods, you find very, very little religious toleration.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. We're going to take one more break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media, and we'll be right back. I'm Pete Sox, the host of Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. Head on over to my show page at breadboxmedia.com and support my show and our work here at Breadbox Media by becoming a premium member today. And we believe it's more about giving than receiving. When you become a premium member for just $9.99 a month, you unlock incredible discounts from our sponsors like Rugged Rosaries, Catholic Books Direct, Lifeboat Coffee, the Mass Box, and the Harrisburg Senators, just to name a few. And it's even better. Every month, Breadbox Media chooses a nonprofit organization to partner with, and 10% of every premium membership is dedicated to that nonprofit. Join the revolution in Catholic media. Become a premium member by visiting my page today. Redbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic Blogger. Today we're being joined by Father Charles Connor, and we're discussing his book, Pioneer Priests and Makeshift Altars, A History of Catholicism in the 13 Colonies. Fascinating topic. Again, great book. Glad you wrote it. Glad you were asked to write it. I want to return to the Caughnawaga Chapel a bit, and you know, maybe I'm a bit biased.
Well, you have good reason to be. That's okay. All of us who live in these terrains are historically biased. I think we live amid such wonderful history in Pennsylvania and in Maryland here.
Yes, we do. So, and the reason I want to return is a lot of the times when I talk with people in the Catholic world, authors and the like, is I like to bring up the Caughnawaga Chapel because to me, in some sense, in this area at least, and in probably the greater parts of Western Pennsylvania, it was the hub of Catholicism at the time when it was built. So can you tell us a bit about how the Jesuits used the chapel as their hub of evangelization, we'll call it?
Yes, it became a headquarters for them, very much as St. Ignatius at Chapel Point in Maryland became a headquarters for them in that locale. But they went out to, first of all, other colonial sites that would today be both in the Diocese of Harrisburg and also in the Diocese of Allentown. And you will find these old churches and old settlements that were ministered to by these men coming from Caughnawaga. Father James Pellance, for example, is a name that always sticks out in my mind as regards a great Caughnawaga missionary. But they would come and go, you know, they would live the life of itinerant missionaries for a while until these various places in south central Pennsylvania became established. Well, what happened was that as the years went on, after the Jesuit establishment of these early churches and their flourishing, you know, their development and the rest, they were ultimately handed over to these respected dioceses. So the places we talk about that I mentioned in the book and so forth would be long established parishes in the diocese of both Harrisburg and Allentown, and for that matter, we also talk about areas which are still in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, the famous Wilcox home and so forth that so many of the Jesuits went to offer Mass, that ultimately became a parish and is to this day in the Philadelphia Archdiocese. So. There was always one kind of a central mission station, if you will, and Caughnawaga is much to be remembered in colonial annals for that. And the cemetery in Caughnawaga is particularly fascinating. As I say, the graves go back to earlier than the American Revolution, and there are, I can't tell you exactly how many Catholic revolutionary soldiers who were buried in the back of the church, but I think there's somewhat of an accurate record kept in the parish annals there of how many there would be, or at least, a fairly good guess how many there would be. So just a walk through that cemetery is, most of the settlers, by the way, at Caughnawaga, who formed the nucleus, who came to the colonies, who were brought there by the Jesuits, or at least, I should say they brought themselves there, but they were ministered to by German Jesuits. They were primarily, not exclusively, but primarily Catholics from Alsace-Lorraine, which is a kind of an interesting point, too, I think, maybe the strong Alsatian influence. And to this very day, as you know, Peter, descendants of those people are still Caughnawaga parishioners,
yes.
3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 generations down, which makes the Basilica even more fascinating as a parish, considering the old families who still retain their membership there.
Indeed. So I guess in all this conversation we've had today, one of the things that we can take away, and one of the takeaways from your book, Pioneer Priests, is the Jesuits played a huge role in Catholicism in the United States, and had they not been interfaced, we may not have seen the flourishing growth of Catholicism in those early years.
Well, they certainly were the nucleus of it. There's no question about that. And because, you know, conditions became quite, especially with the English Jesuits, of whom there were so many, conditions became just as adverse for the Jesuits in England as they did for all other Catholics. But the Jesuits are an interesting crew. They were involved in many, many political intrigues in Western Europe, and many political leaders were very much opposed to them, and they prevailed on Pope Clement the 13th to have them suppressed in the church, which he did. And so for about 25 years, there was no Society of Jesus. And those who had been Jesuits were former Jesuits. They were diocesan priests. And if they were working here in the colonies prior to the establishment of the Diocese of Baltimore, they would be under the direction of the Vicar Apostolic of the London District, who was a bishop in England but could not use the title bishop purely because he was living in England. But he was their ecclesiastical superior in any event. So they were reinstated then early in the 19th century and began to grow and flourish and do what they had done so well in Europe for centuries, and that is establish so many Jesuit universities here in the United States. They of course, were the great counter-reformers in Europe in the aftermath of the Protestant Revolt, and particularly in the aftermath of the Counter-Reformation, the Council of Trent. One of the great beauties of that Council of Trent was the work of the Jesuits on the continent in establishing universities that in those times became bastions of Catholicism, defending the great truths of faith against the ravages of Protestant error. So, they had quite a pedigree before they even became missionaries here in the New World. But what they did in the British colonies was positively outstanding. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, Father, I just wanted to thank you for writing such a great book. Again, I was fascinated with it because of my geographic location to the events described.
Yeah.
But again, it's a great read for anybody that has any interest in the early history of the church in the United States. And before we go, I want to give you a chance to speak of any other books you've written that you'd like to share and where people can find your books.
Well, I think you can probably find them on Amazon for the most part. I know you can for mm-hmm. the most part. I began about 18 years ago, and Ignatius Press published my first two books. One was Classic Catholic Converts, telling the stories of so many who had converted to the faith. And the second was Defenders of the Faith in Word and Deed. And they would be saints and lay people and the rest throughout the course of history who did so much to build up the true faith. Then Alba House published a number of books that I had written, The Saint for the Third Millennium, which is a study of Thérèse of Lisieux, the Catholic world always called the Little Flower.
Mm-hmm.
The Spiritual Legacy of Archbishop Fulton Sheen is another book I wrote with him. Meditations on the Catholic Priesthood. And finally, John Cardinal O'Connor and the Culture of Life. So they were all my books by Alba House. And as you mentioned, now this recent one is by Sophia Press and published circulated by EWTN Television, yes. EWTN Publishing as well.
Mm-hmm. Any other books in the making that we should know about, or is that?
Well, some thoughts rolling through my mind, but they're very, very early thoughts, so we better not say anything yet. I better be careful, in other words.
Yes, yeah. So any closing thoughts?
Well, the closing thought would be this. We have a glorious Catholic heritage here in the United States, and it would really be a wonderful thing if through catechetics or through adult education courses, online courses from the Catholic Distance University and groups of that sort, and more of our Catholic people could indeed have access to reading about the wonderful heritage, the great people who built the faith in the United States, and most particularly the really tremendous adversities and problems that they had to encounter for the spread of the faith, because they were real heroes and heroines, and it's a story that certainly must not be lost sight of.
Indeed. Well, that's all we have time for today, Father Charles. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule and spending it with us.
honor to be with you, Peter. Very much so.
Thank you. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And until next time...